Time for us to begin our study this evening. If you would open your Bibles to the text of Joshua. We are ready to think about entering the land. Joshua doesn't jump right in there, but it's close. Before we get into the text, though, if you would bow with me in prayer, we'll use that as a way to start our study. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessings that we find in Christ. Our hope and our desire that as we begin to worship and to study and to consider your will tonight, that you open our hearts to your word, help us to be good listeners, help us to ask the right questions to grow our faith, discipline us as needed so that we can be more useful in the kingdom. And this is our prayer in your son's name. Amen. All right, so the first thing we're going to do as we begin this text out to play is to take a few moments and lay out some of the groundwork for what's in Joshua. There are a couple of key things you probably remember already. Big picture items, big picture ideals. But as we do so, you'll want to take a few notes perhaps to kind of look back to. We've been talking about this a lot. Joshua as a book is structured by God in some ways to accomplish some goals. It's not a history like we're used to. And I want to stress that, especially now that we've moved off of the first five, and now we're moving into the second phase of about three or four phases, depending on how you break up that last one, of the history portions of the Old Testament, and explain this. When we open a history book today, and we're looking for, let's say, I want to dig into the story of D-Day. I want to know what the Day of Days was like. We will probably see things like timelines. We'll see things like very specific numbers. How many landing craft? How many beaches? How many paratroopers? What was the casualty rates? Who were the officers involved, right? Those are the kind of things we expect to see in a history book about those events. What were the objectives? Did they meet those objectives on that day? Kind of structurally stuff like that. That's what we're looking for. That's a typical Americanized history book, focus on details, focus on structure. Ancient Near East textbooks, if you will, styles of history writing. And ancient Near East is biblical writings primarily for our purposes right now. Do not record history that way. They don't always give us a timeline, do they? Sometimes it's just like, stuff happened. And if you're named Mark, if you look at the Gospel of Mark, by the way, everything in Mark happens immediately. It's like the most common transition word, and Mark likes to say immediately, and then immediately, and then immediately. Because there's a certain sense of his personality coming across, too. You can see that he's different from the other Gospels that way. But all of them have structures that have little to do with the sequence. So we're going to note some times where the sequence is less important. It's not that they're not laid out sequentially, that this happens than that. It's that the sequence is not the important thing. So keep that in mind. Secondly, history as written in the Old Testament is not written with an eye towards detailed accuracy of the things you and I might want. Going back to our illustration of D-Day, we might really want to know about casualty rates because we're deeply concerned with the emotional value of the officers making that choice to send those units in and how many lives they were having to hold in their hands. History books, as written in the Bible, don't do that. They don't have those kind of details. Certainly not the ones we're always looking for because their goals are different. And also there's this. We've seen it already in the first five. Sometimes they shift from fact-telling to what we would call hyperbole of ideas. And that is, they're telling a grand tale. And so the numbers become less important and actually vanish from the text. It's not about the numbers anymore. And it's about the people, the personalities, the emotions, and the attitudes. And it shifts from narrative fact-telling to poetry. And you'll see that happen like when the close of Deuteronomy, they have a song. There's going to be some sections of Joshua and the following books also that have song-like elements to them when you have speeches. Have you ever been to a political speech, by the way? Raise your hand if you've sat at a political speech. I remember listening to Jack Kemp at the campus of Bowling Green, Kentucky, George Bush before he was running for president. He was at the commencement speech for Texas A&M University. Those were political speeches. And they speak really positively, really broadly, and no details. It's like, everything's going to be great. You're going to see some of that, both from God's people who are failed, and the enemies. One of them we're really familiar with, the conversation between David and Goliath. That's a lot of taunting going on, right? Come out. Oh, this is what you can send to me? Who's man enough to take me? That's taunting. And we see that. We see that kind of stuff take place in Judges. We see that kind of stuff take place in the greater stories later down the road, in 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Chronicles. We see a lot of that kind of unfurl itself. And it's a pretty powerful thing when you start piecing it all together, because God is telling us a story through all of that. In addition to those components, those key points that you recognize in the bookends that are the texts of now Joshua and Ruth. Joshua and Ruth, and this is a neat little tidbit if you want to kind of remember this way. We know, and we can remember, that Joshua goes downward. Things get worse, things get worse, things get worse. And then Judges is like they pulled the drain on a clogged sink, and everything that was worse just flushes down the drain and gets as bad as you could possibly imagine. Judges, by the way, has a kind of a cylindrical structure to it, where things that happen at the first part of the book are kind of replicated in other ways in a negative sense at the last part of the book. And I've mentioned before that Ruth is where everything rises. Well, there's a great structural thing that happens in chapter 2 of Judges that we'll talk about when we start laying out these chapters that is a nice parallel to it. But let me start throwing these things up there for some structure for myself to also kind of keep on plan. There are going to be a number of parts, if you will. I think four parts is what we use to the text of Joshua. And one of the ones I want to highlight for us is Joshua chapter 2 in a second. We're actually going to go back and look at the whole text here sequentially when we go through the book. But what happens in Joshua 2? What are some of the major events there? We have what taking place? Who goes in? What kind of people go in again? Spies go in again. But the spies have a different experience. So the spies of Joshua 2, different than Joshua and his buddy Caleb and the other spies in the way that their work goes? Hey, Joshua's been read for us. And that's the voice I hear a lot. That's the Logos reading app voice. That's how I keep up with my Bible reading, is it's read to me sometimes digitally. So, when those spies go in, they meet someone. Who do they meet? Rahab. Is that a weird story? If you don't think it's weird, you haven't read it before. It's a really weird story until you take two steps back. Because sometimes we're looking so closely about her deception, what kind of person she is, her job. Her job never gets washed away from her situation. Because in the text of Hebrews, what is she? She's called, New American Standard says prostitute. There's other, harlot is another term that's used. Just for understanding, the word that's used in the Old Testament that's to describe her work, the more common form is used, although it's only a hair's breadth difference from the kinds that would be attached to the cults and the false gods and the pagan practices. So there's really a gray line that exists linguistically between the two, but you don't really think about that that much. Her profession is never under question historically as to what she did. That's an accurate sense of whom she was. But her story is actually a story of conversion. And it sets there at the beginning of the text of Joshua when everything's kind of great and she's converted in essence to Israel. The story of Ruth and Moab, or the whole picture of the families of Moab, and that transition from her being outside, Ruth being on the outside, coming into The inside is also a story of conversion. And so you have nice little bookends to kind of think about this really bad period of time for spiritual Israel. Begins with a conversion spiritually to Israel, and it closes off at this point with another story of conversion in the marital relationship of Ruth and all of that that plays out in that regard. So that gives us some structure on the big side. We narrow into Joshua now. We've got three chunks that are always kind of together. Now we're in the first third and the first fourth of that, part one. You've got, here's some things take place. The promise of God, and there's four funerals. That's one of the structure parts. I love, this is not my particular title, but I love it, so we're keeping it. Dale Davis wrote this, and he says, how to listen to a shady lady's story. And so Rahab's a shady lady. When it's so memorable, it can kind of stuck in my head, and then I'm sticking it there so I can keep it. And she really does engage in conversation and opportunity for the sake of Israel that is special. She finds herself into the lineage of the Christ. If you think about the church at Corinth, it was full of people like her. So her conversion, in part, is a type of their conversion, and if you're willing to digest it, it's a type of ours too. Because we're not that far removed from any of these people. And for all antiquity and all history and all future, she's still remembered for it, of whom she was and who she became. Going across the flow in Joshua 3 and 4, part 2 is really taking of the land. Just some structural things that take place going through chapter 5 all the way to chapter 12. Joshua 10 is fun because it's in Canaan's Dixie, which is the south. And so that is something you can remember kind of the details about that. And you can kind of remember structurally where some of these events take place. Part 3 is the possession of the land. That's chapter 13 through verse 21. And some of the things that take place there are basically talking about the where, the when, and the structure of the land dimensions. Part 4 should have actually a 21, 20, and 22 there. But what kind of alter? You know, what changes when sacrifices change? Is the first part of that. Staying on edge, and then there's a covenant renewal that takes place at a site specific to Abraham or Abram historically. And so Joshua as a book is really exciting in a lot of ways. There's a lot that goes on, even though it's kind of awful, right? Joshua isn't a happy place. Michael sent me a question. We were talking about the text today because I think he was reading ahead and getting ready. And we were talking about, I think Michael's question had to do with Rahab and her lying and deception and how that seems to be one of the focal points that we sometimes look into. Like, what's all that about? Because we know that God talks about lying in other contexts. So what's going on? Well, remember this. That's welcome to Joshua. You're going to see a lot of people making complicated choices that we know that God isn't pleased with us, with them individually, and He makes use of them. Remember this other factor. We're seeing like 2 days of a person's life. Maybe 3 days of a person's life. Maybe a week. So they are more than just this. And so we can dissect that day to the minutest detail. But remember, we don't have the whole picture. The story isn't written for us to understand necessarily all the reasons why they made those choices. It's telling us something else. There's something bigger in that story we're trying to get than just one person's actions on one day, even though it may have mimicked some things that were really important. Bobby? Well, my perspective of the text here is in Joshua 2 is the beginning of our conversion. This is basically her converting to being part of spiritual Israel in the big sense, specifically physical Israel in the narrow sense. And so we can refer to it as a convert. No different than the others who were not physically Israel, but were accepting the covenant from Egypt till now. And no different than the eunuch, most likely, as well. And so not physically Israelite by birth, but if you're going to call Jesus Israelite, then you're going to have to include her in that lineage because she's part of it. All right, so Joshua chapter 1. We know how the closeout of the chapter 34 is. Israel mourning the death of Moses. Moses' bones are off limits, so they can never build a temple to Moses, and they would have. And to be fair, that's what people do. We have shrines to the dead generals of dubious behavior across our nation. Guys who did some good stuff, did some bad stuff, we build them a temple. We call it a statue. We call it a school. Moses did much more. And so it makes every reasonable sense to see the value of not allowing that to take place. For the text right here, right. So it begins, let's go ahead and read verses 1 through 9 to begin with. Matthew, Brett, would you read that for us? Joshua chapter 1, verses 1 through 9. All right, so as is often the case in life, so it is in the text of God's people, things happen at big family gatherings. And the death of Moses, the funeral of Moses, is the biggest family gathering of all. And now they have to shift everything. We've talked a lot about that already, the shift of command, the shift of leadership. In verses 1 through 9, there's a couple of structural things to think about, particularly in the first 9 verses to start with. There's a repeated phrase. And whenever there's a repeated phrase, that means either God needs us to hear it more than once, the speaker thought it was important, so they said it more than once, or some combination of the two. So that combination phrase, some translations render it different ways, but it says, be strong and courageous. Some translations say, be bold. That's a thing that seems to match Joshua, right? We kind of have a song about that, right? What's our song about Joshua? Dare to stand like Joshua. Be strong and courageous. So strong and bold. What's interesting to think about Joshua and Moses under the picture of Solomon and David. Moses comes to the table of leadership with an attitude of, I can't, I won't. And God basically kind of scoops him up and says, here's Aaron. Here's what you asked for. Aaron will help you. And then does Aaron do much after that? He doesn't. He's there. He's kind of leaning on him. He doesn't really do much from the textual standpoint of what the scriptures show us. Moses is like, okay. But then the story that is told of Moses is that he is one who is meek or humble in his demeanor. That's who leads Israel from Egypt to the edge. To Joshua, Jehovah, Elohim says, be bold and courageous. That's a lot different than the Moses we met, right? From the get-go, we've got a different skill set being expected. Now, we don't know the whole backstory of their behavior, the characters. We know there's a difference there. David and Solomon, is there a parallel difference? In principle, at least? So, David, what kind of guy was he? A warrior, man of war, man of blood. There's blood on your hands, so you can't. Instead, another guy's going to do it. Who's the other guy? Who builds the temple? Solomon. David did all the preparation work, gathered up everything that was necessary. In essence, laid it out, had the Legos put out with the instructions for his kid to come together and put the blocks together. Now you'll never be able to forget that if you've ever played with Legos. Especially if you've done it with a small child, because all your whole job as a small child is just to get them ready. And the kid puts the blocks on. Now you're building the tabernacle every single time. That takes place there in the way that that lays out. Okay, Moses. He got all the pieces and parts of Israel ready. Everything necessary for worship, both structurally and literally. The people of God were made ready through his leadership. But God said, you're not bringing them in. Primarily due to his own rebellion. But Joshua does. So he takes everything that was laid out for him and he brings it in. He brings it in. And so there's a nice literary parallel that exists in the way that God has told us the story, has showed us and revealed it, and should help us remember it. Should help us key into it and say, okay, hey, there's going to be some differences there. There's going to be some parallels in principle that will be valuable to us. Further, there's a couple of other repeats in those first 9 verses or so. I will be, or I am, with you. That's a powerful encouragement. There's a sense of stability that Joshua is hearing and needs to hear that God is with him. Could you imagine being Joshua, for as wonderful as we see him now? And he steps out there, says, all right, Israel, it's time to go. And Israel goes, yeah, he's no Moses. Is that a pretty human response? That's not what we don't see the text kind of laying it out that way, but I can understand seeing that perception helps us kind of see the shift of leadership and while Joshua needs to know that God is with him. That's something Joshua gets from the beginning, is knowledge of that. So that when he steps up and the pangs of doubt that could exist from someone who was just told to be bold and courageous, he says to himself, I'm no Moses. Because is he a Moses? No. But Moses is not Joshua. That's the other half of it that's important to catch too. So you have be bold and strong, be bold and courageous. That's 3 times repeated there. I am, or I will be with you, is repeated twice. And further, early in the text, it lays out, I'm giving this to you. The pledge and the promise picture starts coming back into play. I'm giving it to you. That's laid on the backdrop of Israel's participation in the faithful side of it. They've got to go do, but God's with them in the process. I'm giving it into your hands, and in essence, you're going to do this. It's all possible for you to be successful. When he says, I am giving, I am with you, think forward to the moments where God, through Joshua and through Israel, does the uncommon thing to prove his point. Yeah, you don't need a big army. Just pick up a few. Does that make any tactical sense for those who have seen at least one military movie? You don't have to see it. You don't have to actually even be a military guy to know that overwhelming force is really powerful. I think Patton was the one who codified the idea of victory comes from getting the firstest with the mostest. And so that's a tactical perspective of the biggest army there, you're the first one there, you're probably going to win. Well, Joshua does none of those things. And yet, as God is with him, victory comes. So there's some of that that takes place that we see in the text. So that's what I've seen before we get into the rest of the chapter. What did you guys see in those first 9 verses?
It also tells us something that never stayed on the water.
Right, that's a different kind of instruction that doesn't seem to find its way into other histories of peoples of this era. That makes Israel different. Where the leader, both militarily and in essence spiritually, is being kind of tasked with these same things. Because it's a shift. The Egyptian armies, more often than not, were led by their generals, not by the pharaohs. The pharaoh had a different role. It wasn't until later that you saw the rise of the political city-states where you expected both scholars and soldiers out of the same man. And so this era, that's a little different there too. But on God's side, he wants his people to have a leader who knows who he is and lives that way. What else is in here that's interesting or important to you guys? Right now, those first 9 verses, if you want to jump down farther, you can. Les? Sure.
Moses prepared the people to follow Joshua. In 34, verse 9, it says, Joshua, son of Nun, full of the wisdom of spirit, Moses obeyed his son, so the people of Israel obeyed him.
Yeah, that's part of that trend. Like we looked at last week a little bit just in survey. A passing of the responsibilities and Moses signifying this is the guy. And that happens historically too in other contexts. It still doesn't change the strain and stress on everybody involved. Israel had to change too with that. And we can kind of see that just looking a couple back, even farther back as Les pointed out. We go a little further. Moses was being worn out because he was the guy. And they spread the leadership pool a little bit further. Now Joshua is stepping into that role. And he's going to do the Joshua-level job. It's a different thing. It doesn't mean it's better or worse. God has a different plan for him. Because again, he's not Moses, but Moses was not Joshua. Bobby? It's certainly the similar principles are in play there where there's an expectation of stay with the standard. Further catch this, the success of Israel outside of Joshua, but also inclusive of Joshua, always hinges on the spiritual connection that Israel has with God. So him telling him to keep the law, to stay within those standards, and it equates to success because of the covenant. Michael? By the way, anywhere else in the Bible do you find like a question being asked over and over again trying to prove a point? Maybe 3 times? 3 questions? Yeah. I love it when the text works for me rather than against me, where it shows those things of intertextual connection. Yeah. And in those interactions, you know, tend my sheep. So you can kind of see those other, like there's a couple of times where that kind of method is used. We do the same thing. We use those same methods to reinforce ideas. And we capture ideas both from the Bible and from our family experiences to make a point to people who are around us. Like we said before, Moses could be considered the most plagiarized preacher of the Bible because everyone copies him and never gives him any credit. But Joshua comes in a quick second at times early on where what God says to Joshua, we repeat it a lot. We repeat it in songs. We repeat it in our conversations. We catch those ideas quite often. All right, second half of the first chapter. This is verses 10 through 18. Let's go ahead and read that one together. Let's see. Steve, do you want to read that for us? All right, so there's a couple of things that shift there. We'll talk about the layout of it in a moment. I can't remember the exact date. We're a couple of days away, maybe about a week and a half. Quite a few years ago, members of the 75th Ranger Regiment parachuted into Panama. You guys remember that in the news? Those of us who are a little older, about them dropping into Panama and taking the airfield. One of my friends, Jesse Scoutmaster, was one of those guys who did that. And the lead up for that, they are on the runway going through all their checks. They've had one meal, one big meal. And that's all they're going to eat until resupply comes. Because every ounce of space they had in their bags and their equipment, they were putting all their equipment into and every ounce of ammo they could find because they were going in their minds to war. They believed 100% that this was going to be a major thing. And so their mindset shifts. And they talk now as they're getting ready to go to a reunion about that event, about all the things that went through their minds. What was going on and all the experiences and all their fears and all their excitement and all the concerns. When Joshua is telling Israel this, this is kind of that same kind of thing. We're about to do the thing. And they've been getting ready to do the thing for how long? 40 years and change. You imagine at some point, you got some folks who would be struggling with, are we ever going to do this? Those are the kids in the back seat saying, are we there yet? You have those with a map in the passenger seat saying, we're almost there. And you got the driver just going along and doing what he can do to make sure no one kills each other inside the car before they get there. They're about to do it. They're about to cross over. They're about to accomplish everything that God has in store for them. And so the level of excitement, structurally and textually and historically, has to be way up here. And when he's talking about them getting their preparations together that kind of seem a little bit mundane on some levels, this is a big, big moment. But it comes on the heels just a month prior to the end of Moses. And so there's a bitter pill underneath of this, because Moses still is a huge part of Israel. Even though he's not there, really, he's like he and Abraham. We're Moses' people. We're Abraham's people. Like, they are the icons of the identity of Israel, really even surpassing David. Think for a second. In the New Testament, when Jesus is on the stage, does anyone talk about David? The Sadducees, the Pharisees make equations of a weird part of David's kingdom. The only thing that happens about Solomon really later on is they weep because the temple isn't as good as the one he made. And that's an inter-temple section. Because the temple that surrounded the time of Christ was like five times bigger than Solomon's temple, physically bigger. It wasn't physically as wealthy as Solomon's temple, but the structure of it was massively larger than Solomon's. That's the Herod rebuilt, expanded version of the temple. So they're looking right now at Moses, shift background, we're going in, we're doing it, everything's going to happen. Structurally in the text, as we're kind of seeing just as there were in those first nine verses, here's some other stuff in verses 10 through 18. Joshua gives to them a command to go forth in action and kind of breaks it up into three sections for us to think about. The first one is given to the people through the officers. Pass this on to the men. And I've already used my D-Day analogy, but I'll use one more. All of those participants in D-Day, they were receive a letter from the high commander of the Allied forces giving them encouragement and explaining to them the necessity and the weight that was on their shoulders as they stepped in. History tells us that also on that same day when that letter was handed to all those soldiers, that he also drafted a resignation letter if it didn't go well. If it was a failure, he already had his resignation letter signed and ready to go because of how much he saw in that. Well, this is kind of a way to think about this. So that first layer that goes through the officers, the leaders, the captains of the people is, this is the land that Jehovah is giving to you. Yahweh is giving you this land. Secondly, there's a reminder, verses 12 through 15. What was the agreement? The tribes that already had their land. You better go in. Yeah, you better go in or you'll be treated how? Just like the heathens that we crushed. You'll be cut off. In fact, you'll be destroyed. And so it's structurally important that as they go to the edge of the land and are about to go in, Joshua reminds them of their promise. You better keep your promise. Your promise is important. That's a powerful point there. Third thing, and by the way, it's a reminder that the land Yahweh is giving us repeats again there. Thirdly, this is again verses 16 through 18. This is where we see the culmination of Les's point that takes place at the end of chapter 34 for Deuteronomy. And they answered Joshua. The people come back and say to Joshua, all that you have commanded us, we will do. And wherever you will send us, we will go. That's a pledge level on their part. By the way, does that phrase look familiar to you if you've read other portions of the Old Testament? Does it sound familiar from maybe a book we're about to see? That was very Ruthy, right? The text of Ruth, your people, wherever you go, I will go. You're seeing some interplay and ideas here to talk about the way people conversed and talked, but it's very much poetic on a level of covenant-type pledge. We are promising. Here's a good way to think about it. That statement is equivalent, at least structurally and linguistically, to the pinky swear. You ever do that as a kid? Pinky swear. Is that like a more significant thing than just saying you're going to do something when you're a kid? Right. And the only real level above the pinky swear is the double dog dare. Like, that's like the highest level of kid commitment. I double dog dare you. But basically, if you don't do that thing, you're shunned for life, is the emotional feeling of that. That's right. They're still the get out of jail free card. Huh? Wait a minute. Just as a side note, did you all check when you were kids to see if people were crossing their fingers? All right, I'm just making sure I'm not the only one. So textually, you see them engaging in conversation that is equivalent to covenant keeping. That Joshua is partly making a continued covenant to Israel. They're making a commitment, a covenant-type commitment back to them, back to the leadership. But all of those are under the umbrella of Jehovah. Because Yahweh is the one being identified on both sides. Yahweh will give. Elohim will give. Jehovah will give. God will give. And each of those interactions or exchanges of commitment and blessing. This is also a highly positive section of the text. With the exception of just a reminder to the tribes on the other side, does it have that curse structure that the rest of the law does? Is it like really awful, like everything awful, everything's going to be bad? Or does it sound more like a political speech at a rally? Which one does it seem to fit more? Political speech? Or like economic forecast bad? Political speech in some ways, the feel of it. Everything's good. It doesn't mean that it's a hollow promise. We tend to think of political speeches as hollow, as not real, there's no value to them. But there actually is, even in the ones that are kind of puffed up, there's value to them. In this case, while it feels in that very positive sense, it still is contractual or covenantal in its connection to God and them. And so there is blessings being doled out in that process. And then that's how Joshua opens up for us. And Joshua goes this way, and then we're going to go into the story of Ruth. And so that's kind of why Ruth happens right where it does. It doesn't happen at the beginning of it, because it gives us what we call a literary prologue. There's a little introduction to what's about to happen, and then it opens up with Rahab and her conversion at the edge of the spies. You can picture it, by the way, and we're about done. I think the clock's about to tell us we have to be done. You can picture it, if you want to, like a movie. And it opens up with the prep phases and the training montage. Everyone's getting ready. And then the curtains reveal to the spies sneaking in and starting off the great escapades that are about to take place. And so then that story starts to unfold and explain the rest of the story after that. Thanks, everybody. We should be then in Joshua chapter 2 on Sunday morning.